This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. This may sound like a bunch of kids at a birthday party, but to some children in this therapy session in Gaza, the noise sounds like a bomb.
Many are bedwetting. Some bite their nails or have nervous twitches. They're afraid, especially at night.
In Jamaica, a street vendor gives fruit to people who can pay and to people who can't.
This is tangerine, mango, and so oranges. Yes, yes, sir, I can give you an orange.
Okay, thanks. And
this week's Top of the Pops from Jamaica. Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was just in Egypt for an international conference on the reconstruction of Gaza. She announced the U.S. will contribute $900 million in aid. This is what she said in her speech.
A child in Gaza has the same right as a child anywhere in the world to a good education, to health care, and to a better future.
But children in Gaza are facing another problem in the aftermath of the Israeli invasion. Dale Gavlak reports from Gaza City.
It seems like a birthday party. About three dozen six-year-olds scramble on a huge rainbow-colored tarp in one of their school classrooms. They grab balloons, blow them up, and then let them pop. A green one bursts and then a red one. It's great fun. But then one child named Omar claps his hands over his ears. The blasts remind him of explosions from Israel's recent invasion. And that's when it becomes clear that this is actually a therapy session. Trauma counselor Fadi Abulkhain says many of Gaza's children are disturbed by any sudden sound after hearing bomb blasts.
This exercise helps them to vent their stress while giving them some control over the bursts. Games, drawing, dance, and other forms of therapy are being used to help kids release emotions.
As they play, he asks the children whether they felt afraid during the Israeli offensive. Asil, who plays with the yellow balloon, says every time the bombing began, he and his family would flee, trying to find somewhere to hide, and his little brother would start to cry. Abulkhain says that most of these children cry even now when they hear an explosion or any loud noise.
Many are bedwetting. Some bite their nails or have nervous twitches. They're afraid, especially at night. But I hope they will overcome these difficulties.
Another therapy session is taking place at the Anjalut Islamic Girls' School in Gaza City. This time, students are drawing pictures about what happened to them during the war. One girl has drawn tanks and airplanes approaching her house. 12-year-old Almaza Al-Samouri is one of the students participating today. She says her mother, four siblings, and several uncles were killed in a bombing raid. When you see your family killed in front of you and you're unable to save them, it's a big shock, she says. I want to become a first aid nurse because if this happens again, I would be able to treat them so they wouldn't die. Speaking outside his grandfather's home, 9-year-old Amir Musba says his family of eight initially hid in their house as Israeli F-16s flew overhead. As they started bombing, he says, we headed to a nearby school. Amir says he wasn't aware that his father was shot dead. He thought he had been arrested. Amir hesitates and begins to get choked up. Later, he says he found two bodies in a field, and he recognized his father's shoes and knew he was dead. But it's been hard to take in. Now, Amir's grandfather cares for him. World Vision, the sponsor of the World Vision Report, is also using art and drama as ways for the children to express their feelings about the war and its aftermath. Mohammed Al-Halabi works with the organization here.
The country and Gaza Strip, it needs to many years of implementing psychosocial program to cope, to let the people here, to increase the resilience of people here, and also to decrease the trauma that children are suffering from. We were trying to plant the seeds of peace in their hearts and in their minds. I think now our task will be more difficult.
That's because of what Gaza's children have witnessed during the war. Jordan's Queen Rania, UNICEF's special envoy, has called on the international community to help rebuild Gaza's schools. 7 were totally destroyed, while about 180 were partially damaged. Rania, who is of Palestinian origin, says that schools are more than just a place of education. They are a place for children to heal and to learn tolerance. And indeed, psychologists say that children who feel safe, secure, and who have education are less likely to turn to extremism. When 6-year-old Asil was asked whether he could see a future peace with Israelis, he responded with a determined no. When asked why not, he said, "That's just how it is. They're afraid of us, but we're not afraid of them." For the World Vision Report, I'm Gail Gavlek in Gaza City.
It's been a year since the president of Kenya and the leader of the opposition agreed to share power in the country. That came after disputed elections unleashed waves of ethnic violence. More than 1,000 people died. Ernest Waiteto is a journalist in Nairobi. He joins us every now and then to tell us what's going on in his community. Ernest says Kenyans are relieved that the power-sharing agreement has led to peace, but they don't have such a favorable opinion of the two parties in power.
Kenyans have started to see the leaders as self-serving, people who just wanted to get to power for the sake of getting there and enriching themselves and a few of their friends and colleagues. The rest of the population is still suffering.
And I understand that what you've learned in the last year in Kenya, what people on the street are learning, is that these two leaders aren't as good as they looked a year ago. In fact, they didn't necessarily want peace, that they might have been responsible for a lot of the violence.
That's very true, Peggy. And it's come out, a lot has come out in the light, and people have known how these leaders, they took advantage of the ethnic differences of their supporters as a way to rise to power. And of course, also, some of them paid the youth to go and fight others. So a lot of bad things have come out, and people are not very happy about the two leaders and the parties that they represent.
What is going on? How are the people faring now in Kenya?
The people are not doing very well. Kenya just declared famine a national disaster. And it's feared that 10 million people might be starving or might starve in this country if elaborate plans were not put in place. A lot of food was destroyed during the post-election violence. And beyond that, the economy has not gotten back to where it was.
All right, Ernest. Well, we hope it is a good week for you.
Yeah, it is, especially because there is peace. Perhaps that alone is enough to celebrate.
Ernest Waiteto is a journalist based in Nairobi, Kenya. And a recent power-sharing agreement in Zimbabwe has also led to the creation of a coalition government. But Robert Mugabe, who's been in power there since 1980, is still president. He threw a birthday party for himself last week. It cost $250,000. The celebration took place despite the fact that Zimbabweans are starving. Plus, a deadly cholera epidemic is still spreading across the country. We asked reporter Tendai Maposa what people are saying about Mugabe's birthday bash.
People felt that it was extremely insensitive for him to go ahead with this bash when there are thousands of people dying of cholera, and the half of the population of Zimbabwe will have to get food aid from donors. It's like he's not aware of the very serious problems that this country is facing.
Yeah, well, he hasn't seemed to be aware in quite some time.
Yeah, he seems to live in a parallel universe. You know, it's like so detached and disconnected from the reality on the ground, because as he was celebrating his birthday, the new Prime Minister, Morgan Tsvangirai, was touring one of the biggest hospitals in Harare, which had closed its doors for months because there was no money to run the hospital. But he went there, and it gives the people a certain hope that maybe things will work out. And nobody has seen Mugabe visiting any of these institutions. Nobody has seen Mugabe visiting the people who are suffering from cholera. So it's a tragic story that is unfolding in Zimbabwe.
Yes, it is. And we will be tracking it with your help, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Tendai.
You're most welcome, Peggy.
Tendai Maposa is a journalist in Harare, Zimbabwe. We just heard from Tendai Maposa about a hospital in Zimbabwe that's shut its doors because there's no money to run it. But it's not always money that's the problem in hospitals in the developing world. Here's this week's Globe at a Glance. The car is a wonderful thing. It gets us from A to B. And now it might also save babies' lives in the developing world. A group in Boston has designed an incubator made of car parts. The headlights provide warmth, the fan is used for climate control, and the car door alarm sounds in a medical emergency. Unlike the $40,000 incubators we have in our intensive care units, this one costs under $1,000. Rich countries have donated thousands of incubators over the years, but a study out of Duke University shows that 96% of the donated equipment fails within 5 years. Machines are then discarded because no one knows how to fix them. With the car incubator, that's not a problem. All you have to do is go to the car mechanic just around the corner. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. Coming up, drug violence flares in Mexico. We look at the effects on one small town. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. There's been an explosion of violence in Mexico since President Calderon decided to crack down on drug dealers. Drug cartels are fighting each other and the police. The federal government is trying to gain control of the situation. Nearly 5,000 people were killed last year alone. The violence touches some of the smallest towns and villages in the country. Alto Tonga is one of them. It's a pretty cobblestone town in the mountains of Veracruz. Conrad Fox visited the town, and he sent us this report.
Chris Bryles, a U.S. aid worker and missionary, has lived in Alto Tonga for about 8 years. As he stands in front of his house on the town's main street, he says in the last 2 years, there's been a dramatic increase in drug-related shootings here.
Well, we've got shootings that go on in the streets now that we never used to. We had one go on in front of our house. The man from the telephone company was working to restore our telephone, and he was on top of the pole, and we had a Old West type shooting going down the main street. He came down the pole and said he'd come back the next day to finish the job because he was too shaken up by it.
A few weeks later, three men were gunned down in broad daylight, a few blocks from Bryles' house, reportedly over a drug-related dispute. Much of Mexico's drug violence is over who controls shipment routes to the U.S. Just a few miles out of town, Bryles carefully drives his pickup along a dirt road, clinging to the side of a mountain face. The slopes are thick with palms and cactus, intermixed with pine trees. Simple mud brick houses can be seen here and there, half hidden by the forest. Life here is hard, says Bryles.
The main staple of food here is the tortilla, and beans and rice are the principal foods. If they have any meat, they will usually take a chicken, kill it, and then they'll make that chicken last 2 or 3 days. And it may be a really warm day here, but they'll be eating soup because maybe all they got left over is the chicken bones.
This remote terrain has long been a hotbed of marijuana production. Bryles says he's frequently seen the plant growing among the corn or beans. We don't find any today, but we come across Leoncio Tapia repairing a fence on the edge of his field. He used to grow marijuana.
Unfortunately, I've had to do it because I'm poor. Most of us poor people, we do it out of necessity, even if we're just planting a little bit that'll give us a quarter kilo or a half a kilo.
For many farmers, marijuana offers a guaranteed income at a time when the price of traditional cash crops like coffee are declining. But the farmers rarely get rich, says sociologist Luis Astorga, an expert on the illegal drug industry.
For many, it's a question of survival, something they couldn't do growing legal crops. But that's just to survive. Everyone knows the ones who make the least profit are the growers themselves. If some of them are dreaming of someday having a nice pickup truck or whatever, it's very few of them who are going to make it.
Leoncio Tapia's family has paid a steep price for being in the drug business. Shootouts with neighbors over land to grow marijuana killed his father and brother. Tapia says that his neighbors stopped growing the drug after a police crackdown a few years ago. So why the violence in the region? Rumors abound of a new, more organized operation further up the mountains. It's too dangerous for me to go, but a contact elsewhere arranges for me to meet a farmer from one of the villages there.
Piedra, que le dicen piedra. Ah, sí, abunda por ahí.
Now it's crack, he says. The farmer doesn't want his name used for fear of reprisals. We'll call him Don Eduardo. The gangs, he says, began growing marijuana 20 years ago, when coffee prices fell. Then, several switched to the more lucrative business of crack cocaine. Village life here used to be peaceful, he says.
Por la droga. Por la droga.
De ahí nació. All that changed because of the drugs.
Empezaron a matar.
They started to kill.
Empezaron a matar. Empezaron a matar.
To kill.
Por dinero y por la envidia.
For the money. For envy.
Por la envidia. Se van matando.
They'll go a long way to kill someone.
Experts agree that the lure of profits, especially in poor regions like Altotonga, makes stamping out the drug trade difficult. Again, sociologist Luis Astorga.
Estos cultivos siguieron el efecto cucaracha.
Drug plantations have experienced the cockroach effect. When the government started eradication campaigns, they just expanded to other parts of the country.
But Astorga thinks that while poverty may first lead many farmers to grow drugs, eventually, the business becomes a family tradition.
O sea, su niñez se desarrolló entre campos de amapola y marihuana, ¿no? Entonces, para
the kids grow up around marijuana and heroin, and they think it's natural, like kids who grew up with Nintendo or computers or whatever.
Don Eduardo admits that this seems to have happened to his family. He and his son used to grow pot. Now his son is one of the chief perpetrators of violence in his village.
Pues quiere tener dinero.
All he wants is money. He's bad. He's bad, that man. Yep. The authorities are scared of him because he's got a gang. He's already killed one man.
Don Eduardo admits that even he's now scared of his son. With drug violence raging across the country, it's the kind of fear many Mexicans are all too familiar with these days. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Altotonga, Mexico.
We've got Conrad on the phone now to give us an update from his home in Canada. You've been back from Mexico for a little while now, but you still have family and friends in that area. What are they telling you the situation is like right now?
In the city where I used to live, in Veracruz State, they're telling me that the tension is running really high. They've been talking about the arrival of the Zetas, which is a band of hitmen that work for one of the drug cartels, but they seem to have taken on a life of their own, and they've been charging extortion money from business people all around town. I called one friend and I asked her, you know, I've heard that things are really bad there in Veracruz. And she was so scared, she actually thought her line was tapped and she didn't want to talk to me. She said, everything's fine. I'll send an email to you later on.
How are they changing their daily life styles around as a result of all this violence?
Well, I should say that, you know, people in Mexico are pretty good at finding a way of getting on with their lives, even in the face of adversity. I know in the city where my wife is living with her kids right now, there were some pretty horrific beheadings. They found 12 cadavers with no heads. And that night, rumors just flew all over the city. People were sending text messages, phone calls. You know, there were rumors of like a military takeover. They were expecting other people to be kidnapped. But then 2 days later, everything was forgotten about and they just got on with their lives. I speak to my wife now and I tell her, you know, the things that I'm seeing in the news here about just how horrific Mexico is. And she says, well, you know, if you don't actually see it, if it's not actually affecting you, you just get on with your life and, you know, live normally.
And we should explain, your wife is from Mexico, you're Canadian, and she's going to join you up in Canada. But right now you're both split up.
Yeah, that's right. We're trying to get her immigration papers together. But I mean, the thing that occupies my mind mostly is just how sad I feel, because I've lived in Mexico for about 10 years. And I was there since before democracy arrived in Mexico. And I sort of really hung my hopes on this country, and I was determined to watch this country flourish. And it was getting better. And in the last 2 years, it's just turned into something almost unmanageable.
Is that why you've left Mexico?
Well, that's one of the reasons. Yeah, I just felt it was uncomfortable. I didn't want to have to explain it to my kids. I remember the night of the beheadings. We didn't say anything to my children. We certainly didn't have the TV news on. But he found out somehow, because the next day, all of his drawings, and he's a prolific artist like most kids of his age.
How old is he?
He's 4 years old. All of his drawings had blood and explosions and guns, where they'd never had anything like that before.
Mm. How soon will they be able to leave and join you in Canada?
In a couple of months, I'm hoping. Got my fingers crossed. I mean, I know they're in no danger, but I mean, every day I look at the news, I can't help feeling a little bit nervous.
Conrad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peggy. It was a pleasure.
That was Conrad Fox speaking to us from Nova Scotia. Each year, thousands of West Africans travel 1,600 miles across the open sea. They're trying to get to the Canary Islands, a part of Spain. If the Spanish can't prove where the boats are from, Spanish law allows the passengers to emigrate to the mainland as undocumented workers. For a poor West African, even undocumented status is like winning the lottery. But to get to that point, you have to take risks. In 2007 alone, nearly 1,000 people died on their way over. Still, they try again and again. Reporter Michael Kavanagh brings us this story.
It's 5:30 a.m., and it's still dark in the fishing village of Cayar. On the beach, dozens of fishermen push their wooden boats into the waves and start up their motors. In the fading moonlight, you can just make out the colorful designs and phrases in French, Arabic, and Wolof painted along the boat hulls, all asking for God's blessing. This is the way Senegalese fishermen have made their living for generations. Up before the sun, out at sea all day, back to shore for the afternoon to unload their catch and send it to market. But recently, it hasn't gone so well.
These days I go fishing and I can't catch anything.
Papa Jiang has been fishing off these shores since he was 12. He's now 27.
Sometimes 2 months will go by and you'll catch almost nothing.
Overfishing by foreign commercial ships, as well as by the multitudes of Senegalese fishermen, has made it nearly impossible for Papa Jiang to make a living. So in January 2006, when he first heard the news that a Senegalese fishing boat had reached the Canary Islands, a part of Spain off the west coast of Africa, it was like a revelation.
I didn't understand it. I'd never heard of that. I thought, that's not possible.
Papa Jiang knew that the islands were 1,600 miles away, at least a week-long journey on treacherous seas. But if a boat could survive that journey...
People started believing that there might be a boat that could take them there too. And they could be free. They could go to Europe, to Madrid or Barcelona. It would be liberation.
Liberation could mean cleaning floors or washing dishes in a hotel in Madrid or doing heavy labor on a farm in the countryside. By the middle of 2006, so many people were leaving in boats from Cayar shores that a Senegalese radio host started calling the beach Senegal's international airport to Spain. Papa Jung's family and a few goats and chickens live about 200 yards from the sea in a compound no bigger than a basketball court. One of Papa's brothers showers with buckets because there's no running water. The family compound is warm and welcoming, but their poverty is unmistakable.
I'm in the house of my father. There are 25 men and 25 girls. 10 of the men have tried to leave.
One of the 10 was Papa Jung himself. On July 31st, 2006, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he crowded into a 50-foot-long fishing boat with 100 other men and women and set off.
I brought a blanket, one pair of pants, and some boiled eggs and biscuits to eat.
The trip was horrific.
The waves were huge. People were angry. Some were crying. They were saying, we have to turn the boat around. Others were saying, no, we have to risk it. We have to keep going. We're going to make it.
One of Cayar's mosques sits right on the beach. Islam in Senegal is overseen by Marabout, who mix traditional Quranic study with Sufism and a bit of indigenous religion. Before the boats start off to the Canaries, they're blessed by the Marabout, who also hand out good luck charms called gri-gri. Gri-gri usually take the form of little leather pouches, and they're sometimes filled with beads or string or hair, or little bits of bone.
In the village, there are a lot of marabout, and they give the gri-gri to help people on the journey. It helps them become invisible so no one can see them.
Papa's own marabout says he tries to discourage people from making the journey, but if they insist on going, he feels like he has no choice but to bless them and give them gri-gri. 2 years ago, the marabout tells Papa Jung, there were people who tried to go without gri-gri, and their boats sank. But those who have good gri-gri won't die in the ocean. They'll make it. But just making it to the Canaries isn't enough. After 7 days at sea, in a boat with 100 people and no room to move, Papa Jung finally saw the Canary Islands on the horizon, and the Spanish police lined up along the shore. No one in the boat had identity papers, but their language, Wolof, betrayed them as Senegalese, and they were sent home. Each day in Cayar, when the catch comes in, the women haggle over the price of the fish. We ran into Papa Jung's mother on her way down to the shore. She is a striking 6-foot-tall woman in a white head wrap and a flowing purple robe. Papa translated her Wolof into his broken French.
She says that she wants her children to get to Spain to work. When they went, she cried. She was scared for them. She said that when I came back, she thanked God. It was God's will.
At least 500 men from Cayar alone have been repatriated after reaching the Canary Islands. Thousands more have been turned back even sooner by weather, waves, or by the Spanish Coast Guard, whose helicopters now patrol the waters off Senegal's coast. But as fish stocks continue to fall, the difficulty of the journey seems less of an obstacle. Papa Jung has been planning his next trip for over a year now. To avoid the helicopters, he'll be taking a much longer route. And, he says, he's heard about a powerful marabout in southern Senegal who could help him.
There are boats that go and the helicopters don't see them. Because they take the right gri-gri in their boats.
Oui, Papa says, yes. Looking out at the fishermen and their half-empty boats coming into the shore in the afternoon heat. If they just had the right gri-gri, the helicopters wouldn't see them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michael Kavanagh in Cayar, Senegal.
There's a slideshow to go with this story. It's at our website, worldvisionreport.org. If Papa does make the dangerous crossing to Spain, he might find it's not the land of plenty he'd expected. Daniela Gerson brings us this reporter's notebook from Granada.
As night unfolds, tourists mingle with locals at tapas bars that line every corner of this fabled city. Weaving among them is a lean black man in his mid-30s, who identifies himself only as Mohammed, He enters a crowded bar and flashes a cautious smile.
Hola, amigo, amiga. Película o bien música?
Mohammed, an illegal immigrant from Senegal, grasps a black plastic bag filled with bootleg DVDs. He approaches the bar's patrons, offering movies for sale. The competition is stiff. This tourist district is closely guarded by police, but even so, a growing stream of illegal African vendors flows by, offering similar wares.
Some days, I make about $25. Some days, $5. Some days, $50. Some days, I make nothing. As the Spanish say, nada.
Mohammed may smile, but he isn't happy with his life in Spain. He hasn't found the easy dollars that enticed him to leave his native San Luis, a port city in Senegal. He trained as a carpenter there, but he could barely make enough money to live on. Life in Spain isn't any better. After a month in Granada, Mohammed can hardly support himself, let alone send money back to his family.
Well, why am I here? I wanted to earn a lot of money. That's why I'm here. I want to do it for my father, my mother, my brothers, and my younger sister.
It took Mohammed 6 months to save enough money to be smuggled to Europe. When the day arrived, he joined 80 other illegal migrants and boarded a raft. Of the ensuing 15 days at sea, he will only say it was very hard. Whatever happened, his boat was among the lucky ones and made it to the Canary Islands. From there, it took him several weeks to make his way to continental Europe, in an apartment which he shares with 6 other Africans. Within 3 days of arriving in Granada, he was selling DVDs. He knows it's a dangerous job. The police could catch him at any moment and send him back to Senegal. But it's the only way to make money. A roommate gives him the merchandise to sell. Where it comes from is a mystery to Mohammed.
We have our CDs, and we put them on the ground to sell. It's not normal, but we have to do it to eat.
Enjoying their beers and snacks, the patrons barely look up at Mohammed. Another vendor had passed by 15 minutes before, and no one bought from him either. Undeterred, Mohammed leaves and heads up the hill to the next tapas bar. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniela Gerson in Granada, Spain.
Just ahead, an 82-year-old AIDS activist met with Hillary Clinton in China last month. Now you can meet Dr. Gao after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. China has come a long way in acknowledging that it has an AIDS problem. That's a public service announcement explaining HIV and AIDS in detail. A television campaign about AIDS would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. AIDS first appeared in China in the early 1980s, and it spread rapidly. But few people dared speak openly about the disease for fear of offending the government. One notable exception was Dr. Gao. The retired physician has won praise in China and abroad for her courageous stand. In fact, Hillary Clinton singled out Dr. Gao at a meeting with women's rights activists during the Secretary of State's trip to China last month. But in Dr. Gao's home province, the authorities still treat her like a criminal. Ruth Kirshner met with her in the province of Hainan.
When I knock on the door of Dr. Gao Yaojie's modest two-bedroom apartment in the city of Zhengzhou, she immediately drops her chopsticks, pushes aside her rice bowl, and sits down on her sofa to talk.
I'm more or less under house arrest. That's why I don't want to finish my lunch now. I want to talk. We might have an hour, we might have less. The police could come any minute. Once, when a foreign journalist called me, my phone line was blocked for 2 days afterwards. Nobody could contact me.
The retired doctor is under constant surveillance by the local authorities. She says they've bugged her phone, and she can't go out much, she says, because she's always followed. At age 81, Dr. Gao is frail and a bit hard of hearing. But that has not stopped this tiny, wrinkled woman from creating a stir. In the 1990s, she played a vital role in exposing an HIV scandal in Henan province. Tens of thousands of poor peasants had been infected with the virus after local officials encouraged them to sell plasma to illegal and unsanitary blood banks. Since then, Dr. Gao has worked tirelessly to educate peasants about HIV/AIDS, often using her own pension money to publish books and leaflets and to buy medicine for the sick.
I am a doctor, and as a doctor, I am passionate about my patients. It's my job. In the beginning, when I started going to the villages, I never thought it would turn into such a big thing. I just thought, these people are very poor, and I want to help them and heal them.
These days, the majority of new HIV infections in China are caused by unprotected sex. Dr. Gao is quick to acknowledge that, but she says the risk of getting infected through tainted blood has not been eliminated, despite government assurances that blood banks are safe. That's because some hospitals try to cut corners and buy cheap blood from unlicensed suppliers. Sunya's daughter was infected at the age of 6 through tainted blood transfusions. Speaking in Dr. Gao's apartment, he says he's been fighting for justice ever since. The local authorities cover up cases, he says. They deny that anything went wrong, and they don't allow us to file lawsuits against anyone. Eventually, Sun Ya turned to Dr. Gao for help.
The problem is that in China, laws and regulations are not enforced. Yes, we do have laws to regulate blood donations and transfusions, but there is too much corruption and too many corrupt officials willing to accept bribes to finance their mistresses.
Dr. Gao is no stranger to controversy. She was severely beaten during the Cultural Revolution because she comes from a wealthy family and refused to march with the Red Guards. She survived to resume her career as a doctor. When she blew the whistle on the Henan 8 scandal in 1996, she was already retired. Over the years, not all levels of government have obstructed her work. When I ask about her at a recent press conference in Beijing, an official with the Ministry of Health heaped praise on her. Dr. Gao has done a lot to improve HIV awareness, he says, and to support those infected. We have to acknowledge that. We know that people like her and other grassroots organizations in the countryside face difficulties because local authorities have problems accepting them. That's exactly what's been happening in Henan. The provincial authorities don't want negative headlines about their region and have been trying for years to suppress news about any AIDS scandals. So they continue to harass Dr. Gao, and the central government seems unable to stop them. Last year, local officials tried to prevent her from travelling to the US to pick up an award for her work. But this kind of pressure makes her only more determined to keep going.
I am just a normal doctor, nothing special. Nobody knew me. If the local authorities hadn't tried to prevent me from doing my work, I would never have turned into the person I am now.
And with that, Dr. Gao ushers me out of the door of her crammed apartment. No police have knocked on it yet, but the plainclothes policemen outside her apartment block watch closely as I make my way back to the main road. For the World Vision Report, I'm Ruth Kirchner in Zhengzhou, China.
China's got a new problem these days, the global economic meltdown. There's less demand for Chinese exports because of the downturn. As a result, thousands of small and mid-sized factories are shutting down. But that hasn't stopped people migrating from the countryside to more urban areas in search of jobs. Author Leslie Chang wrote about migrant girls who leave their rural homes and flock to the factories. Chang was born in America, but spent a decade in China, working as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. In her book, Factory Girl, Chang tells the story of Min. Min worked in a factory making alarm clocks and calculators. She slept in a cramped dorm with 11 other workers. She made about $50 a month. But Min wanted more. Here's a reading from Leslie Chang's book, Factory Girls.
She phoned home and said she was thinking of quitting her job. Her parents, who farmed a small plot of land and had three younger children still in school, advised against it. You always want to jump from this place to that place, her father said. Girls should not be so flighty. Stay in one place and save some money, he told her. Min suspected this was not the best advice. Don't worry about me, she told her father. I take care of myself. She had two true friends in the factory now, Liang Rong and Huao Zhao'e, who were both a year older than Min. They washed Min's clothes for her on the nights she went to class. Laundry was a constant chore because the workers had only a few changes of clothes. In the humid dark nights after the workday ended, long lines of girls filed back and forth from the dormitory bathrooms carrying buckets of water. Once you had friends, life in the factory could be fun. On rare evenings off, the three girls would skip dinner and go roller skating, then return to watch a late movie at the factory. As autumn turned into winter, the cold in the unheated dorms kept the girls awake at night. Min dragged her friends into the yard to play badminton until they were warm enough to fall asleep. The 2004 Lunar New Year fell in late January. Workers got only 4 days off, not enough time to go home and come out again. Min holed up in her dorm and phoned home 4 times in 2 days. After the holiday, she went to her boss again, and this time, he let her leave. Liang Rong and Huao Zhao'e cried when Min told them her news. In a city of strangers, they were the only ones who knew about her departure. They begged her to stay. They believed that conditions at other factories were no better, and that to leave or to stay would be the same in the end. Min did not think so. She promised she would return for a visit after she got paid at her new job. Min left that same day, with a few clothes and a backpack, and the 2 months' wages that the factory owed her. She did not take her towels and bedding with her. Those things had cost money, but she couldn't bear the sight of them anymore. In 10 months on the assembly line, Min had sent home 3,000 yuan, about $360, and made 2 true friends. She should have been scared, but all she knew was that she was free.
That was a reading from Factory Girls by Leslie Chang. Japan is also feeling the pinch these days. Its stock market has dropped to the lowest level in 26 years. And a new statistic suggests the elderly are being squeezed. There's been a surge in what's being called gray crime, older citizens breaking the law. Gavin Blair is a freelance reporter in Tokyo who's been covering this topic. I asked him what kind of crimes are being committed.
The majority is petty theft, a lot of shoplifting, some pickpocketing. Although I saw a statistic that assaults are up actually 17-fold over the last 5 years. That is from an incredibly low number, it has to be said, but it's still quite a shocking statistic.
So you've got 75-year-old men assaulting people?
There was a lady of 70, I think, who attacked 2 young people with a knife. And when she was arrested, she told the police she just wanted to be taken care of.
And of course, I assumed it was a 75-year-old man, and here you've got women doing this.
It was a lady with a knife, yeah.
Things are really bad in Japan economically, and especially for the elderly. But how is the overall crime rate? Are young people also having a surge in crime, or is this particular to the elderly?
No, youth crime has been falling in recent years. I don't think this is often portrayed correctly in the media. And if you asked a lot of average Japanese people, I think they would probably tell you that youth crime was increasing, and even the overall crime is increasing, but it's actually been falling. So it really is particularly peculiar to the elderly population at the moment. It's in fact the only sector of the population where crime is increasing. There have been a number of stories of old inmates telling prison authorities that they've committed crimes again in order to be put back inside, because at least they have 3 meals a day and warmth and companionship of people their own age.
You know, that's so interesting, because we think of the Japanese as traditionally really revering their elders. How are people in Japan handling this? I would think it would be a real cultural shakeup.
I think that the truth of the matter is that it's not getting the coverage it should be getting in the media. It's probably an uncomfortable truth, and I don't think it's being picked up. In fact, I've spoken to Japanese friends and acquaintances and said I've been looking into this recently, and they seem surprised to hear the figures themselves. As I said, I think if you ask the average Japanese person, they would be more concerned about youth crime, even though the reality is the complete opposite.
You're a reporter in Japan. Have you interviewed any of the people who have been arrested?
That was more difficult. I've spoken to shopkeepers and shop owners and managers.
What did they tell you?
At first, they were shocked, of course. The first time they saw it happening, they were shocked. And Japan is so traditionally low crime that they're surprised by crime in the first place, and they're even more so surprised by elderly people committing that crime. A lot of them said that the first few times it happened, they warned people and didn't call the police and said, please don't do it again, please take care of yourself. And after it happened a few times, they had to call the police reluctantly. They didn't obviously like the idea of these people who were probably their parents, grandparents' ages being sent to prison, but felt they had no choice.
Do you know if there are any efforts underway at all to reach out to this population in new ways?
I haven't heard of any. The only thing I've heard of, unfortunately, is that the government's spending a lot of money on prison wards specially designed to deal with the needs of elderly inmates.
What would that look like?
Presumably the same kind of things that they would have in elderly homes, but in this case, inmates.
Gavin Blair, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gavin Blair is a freelance reporter living in Kawasaki, Japan.
Question, when it's gonna be my time to shine? Now I'm in my prime. Yes, I wanna know when it's gonna be my time to shine. I gotta get what's mine. When it's gonna be a little shine from me. Lyrics and flow are third to the city. Because my full adversity.
You're listening to Time to Shine. It's by Laden, and it's Top of the Pops in Jamaica this week. And that's where we go now to meet one man who has a pretty interesting business model for these stressful economic times. Here's the next installment in our street vendor series from Judith Ritter.
This is tangerine, mango, and so oranges.
Godfrey Poppin has been selling his fruits and vegetables on this busy corner of Burnett Street for 15 years. A large, gregarious man, he stands inside what looks like a carnival pitch-till-you-win kiosk. But he's not touting teddy bears.
The fruits like sweet sap, sour sap, knees berry, guava, and all those things. And we have garlics.
A kind of king of the corner, he often has his photo taken by tourists. You know the shot, the vendor, the pile of fruits, the broad smile of the happy Jamaican. But here's the backstory. Poppin supports a family of six, and on a good 13-hour day, he can make $20. Sound like a hard life? He brushes off the idea of hard. That's his business lesson number one.
Oh, it's not really hard. You have to put your mind to it and just make up your mind and do what you're doing just to achieve something in life.
Today is one of those slower days. Dreadlocked Rastafarians ride by on bicycles. School children in uniforms pass by. With complete concentration, Godfrey rearranges his stacks of oranges, polishes some apples, and steps back to admire his display. He keeps one eye on the passersby for any potential customers. He spots a group of teenagers and women with babies.
Hi, girl. Hi, schoolers. You need any fruits? Hi, baby mother. Baby mother, I'm selling fruits.
No takers. Nope, none. His response? Call it lesson two.
You've got a big smile on your face.
I have to put on a whole big smile to the people them recognize and come and patronize me, right? Yeah, so you have to do it.
The smile works. An older gentleman comes right over, examines the fruit, and asks for an orange.
Yes, yes, sir, I can give you an orange.
Okay, thanks. I'm so proud of you.
In financial terms, the sale is disappointing. But in the Godfrey Poppin business model, a sale isn't just about money. Lesson three, business is about the people you serve.
So how is the day today?
Poppin's regular customers call him Mr. Big. Some of them pay, and some can't. But Poppin seems to make no distinction.
Later on in the day, we have Margie come and say, Mr. Biggs, I need fruit for my lunch. And like tomorrow morning, I have Leroy come and say, you know, boy, the fruits was so beautiful yesterday. I would like to get that dish like that for me, what they gave me yesterday. And I said, oh, sure.
Of course business could be better. And certainly an infusion of a little cash, something he calls upliftment, would help. Poppin does have hopes of growing his business, but modest ones, and for the right reasons. Lesson 4, give back to your community.
And if I have the ability, that's more upliftment, I can even make money and donate it.
Poppin has no idea where that upliftment might come from, but that's okay. Lesson 5, work hard, do what you love. The rest is out of your hands.
I don't have any problem because I just have my mind and the Almighty, so I don't have any problem. My job is very excellent, and I love it. So my job are excellent, yeah.
Poppin turns back to his fruit, picks out a green coconut and chops the top off. He hands it to a rather shabby, tired-looking fellow leaning against the wall.
Beautiful. I get your straw, right? I want to get your straw.
No money exchanged, just smiles. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Montego Bay, Jamaica.
Yeah, get your straw over there, right?
And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can download a podcast of the show on iTunes or at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also read blogs from our reporters around the world. And you can post your comments. We're always interested in your feedback about the show. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.